It is Tuesday, March 15th, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Just ahead, VOA's national correspondent will be here to tell us why today's U.S. presidential nomination contests could be so crucial for the remaining candidates in the presidential race. U.S. Ambassador Christopher Hill tells us what he thinks of Russia's move to start pulling forces out of Syria. And we'll tell you about a new virtual reality mobile app that London tour guides are using to help visitors step back in time.
I think it's just really, really immersive. I mean, my job is a storyteller. I'm here to conjure up what things are like. And this just gives me something else I can use.
It's all ahead on International Edition. Well, it is Super Tuesday Part 3 here in the United States, the third in a series of presidential nomination contests to be held on a Tuesday in various parts of the United States. Republican and Democratic presidential contenders are facing voters in five states today: Florida, Ohio, North Carolina, Missouri, and Illinois. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone is with me in the studio. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Michael.
Well, why is this Super Tuesday potentially so much more pivotal than the two that came before?
We could get some clarity in the race on both political parties with the results coming in later today. On the Republican side, Donald Trump looks to be in pretty good position in at least four of the five states voting. And it's crucial for his rivals, particularly in Florida, where Marco Rubio is from, and Ohio, where John Kasich is from. Both of them essentially are expected to need to win their home states to stay in the race. The prospect doesn't look great for Rubio based on the polls. He looks like he's down by double digits, so barring a big comeback, that's going to be a long story. But the real battle's in Ohio, I think, between Kasich and Trump.
What are the indications from the polls about how Trump and Kasich might do in Ohio?
Very close. The last few polls I've seen had Kasich with a slight lead, but another poll yesterday by Quinnipiac had them actually in a dead heat. They were tied. So we're just going to have to let that one play out and see how it goes in the end. But I think Ohio's important because if Trump can win Ohio, if he can win all five states, it's pretty much going to be a lock. He'll be the Republican nominee. If Kasich can deny him all of Ohio's 66 delegates,
because it's winner take all,
like as is Florida, then we may have a race that may continue on until the Republican convention in July. Trump would certainly have a lead, presumably, but you never know when you go into a convention where you don't have that, you know, firm majority in hand.
And do you think this could be the end for Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida?
You know, he says he's going to go on no matter what the results are in Florida, but a lot of people would expect that the calls will really increase for him to leave the race if he cannot pull off a home state victory tonight.
How about the picture on the Democratic side? We have Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders competing in the same states. And we could potentially see Hillary also do very well in most or all of them. What is the expectation for the Democratic side?
Well, yes, certainly in Florida, Clinton has a big lead, 30 points by some estimates. North Carolina, another southern state, she's doing well. I think the Sanders campaign is really looking at the races in Illinois, Missouri, and Ohio as possible upsets. Now, just a week ago, we had a big upset in Michigan that really spurred on the Sanders
campaign. Sanders was behind in the polls and came back, didn't he?
Yes, he was behind quite a bit and surged. And I think the Clinton people may be concerned about that. Either way, of course, the Democratic race, which is all proportional delegate allocation, will go on for a while. But Clinton has a lead. She hopes to build on that lead this evening. So we'll have to see where the results are in. But Sanders has some potential upsets here to look at.
And it seems like he might have to make a really strong showing to actually overtake Hillary, right?
Yeah, you know,
the delegate race.
He would have to win basically the primaries coming up by like 60% to overtake her. And I think it is going to be a stretch. The question is how divisive and how long does this campaign go on if they're both fighting for delegates?
Thank you so much to our national correspondent, Jim Malone.
You bet.
Well, the U.S. presidential race was the topic of this week's hashtag VOA TV program, which I hosted along with Andrew Palchevsky. Our panelists included Susan Crabtree, a White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner news site, who is with us in the studio. And also via Skype, we had Paul Steinhauser, political director of the NH1 News Service in the state of New Hampshire. I asked Steinhauser how surprising it was that Republican Donald Trump has performed so much better than his critics expected.
Yeah, you know, we picked this up early last year. Donald Trump started coming up here to New Hampshire back in March and April of last year before he announced his candidacy. I was interviewed him a bunch of times, but more importantly, I went to a bunch of his events, and you could sense that anger, that frustration by his supporters with anything to do with Washington, with anything to do with the establishment. So his success here in New Hampshire, he won by double digits here, well ahead of the rest of the field. It was a sign of things to come. It was definitely not an aberration. Talking about the violence at his events the last couple days here, interesting poll from Monmouth out of Florida. 60% of Republican primary voters said they weren't troubled at all, made no difference to them in their vote what happened with the violence at the Trump events. And about 20%, 1 in 5, said they would be more likely to vote for Trump. This is a huge night for Donald Trump, guys. This is either coronation night if he takes Ohio, if he takes Florida and the rest of the states, or it's going to be convention night. If he loses those two states, this thing may go right to the convention. That's why these five contests tonight are so crucial.
Well, as Susan here with me in the studio, you know, the Washington establishment pretty well. The Republican establishment is based here in this city. Why do you think they were unable to see this coming, to see how Trump has done so well in harnessing this anger?
I think that they considered him a businessman, and larger than life businessman, who maybe did not have what it takes to sustain a campaign. It's very tiresome. You know, you have to be out at these events. But guess what? He seems to be up to the task. And not only that, he is such a entertainer. You know, he has really tapped into his celebrity status. I think that's half of this. And actually, you know, Joe Scarborough put it best recently.
He's
read
with MSNBC.
His article. Right. In a column he wrote today for the Washington Post, where he said, in Mandarin, chaos and opportunity are the same word. And he's basically... chaos, he's managed to harness that chaos and use the media to his advantage like no other candidate I have ever seen. And Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and John Kasich cannot compete with his star quality and his just irreverence for the process.
And that was Susan Crabtree from the Washington Examiner. If you want to hear more of that show, you can actually watch it on our hashtag VOA Facebook page. Well, staying with Super Tuesday, we have our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, with us in the studio to tell us what's buzzing online. Hey, G.
Hi, Michael. Hashtag Florida Primary was a trending hashtag on Facebook and Twitter, and there are 99 winner-take-all delegates up for grabs in Florida on the Republican side, and the Democrats have 214 delegates at stake. Let's check out what some of the contenders have posted on Facebook. The leading GOP contender Donald Trump wrote, "A fabulous day in North Carolina, Florida, and Ohio. Remember to get out and vote Trump. I will defeat Hillary Clinton, and we will make America great again."
I've heard that one before, huh?
I know. And he's not even talking about his Republican rivals here, so that's the level of confidence he's projecting to his supporters. And one of his tweets was widely covered by news outlets today, and it reads like this. "A lot of complaints from people saying my name is not on the ballot in various places in Florida, ? Hope this is false."
Well, gee, what is going on there? Has there been any clarification from election officials in Florida?
So they did say his name is not left out on ballots. Florida is a closed primary state, as you know, which means only registered Republicans would get a vote, get a ballot listing Trump and other GOP candidates. So some residents in Jupiter, Florida, who are voting in municipal elections, complained when they didn't see Trump's name on the ballot. So perhaps they were not aware that none of the other presidential candidates were listed on the ballots either.
Okay, well, what are the other presidential hopefuls saying on Twitter today?
So on Facebook, Florida Senator Marco Rubio is really banking on his home state to turn the tide around, writing, "It all comes down to Florida. And turning to the Democratic side, frontrunner Hillary Clinton announced her team will be live blogging Mini Super Tuesday using a Facebook note. And I definitely think this is something all candidates should be doing if they have the manpower to do so.
So the candidates are going strong on Facebook as well, right?
They are. And that's because, you know, they don't have the limitation and they have more tools to use, like the live blogging.
Mm-hmm.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is focusing on increasing the voter turnout. He wrote, "Sisters and brothers," I like the way he put sisters in front of brothers, in Ohio, Illinois, North Carolina, Missouri, and Florida, make your voice heard today. Go vote, hashtag vote together. That's all for me today, Michael.
Thank you so much, G. If you'd like to follow G on Twitter, she is at G Abby Lee, and I'm at Michael _ Lippin. And you can follow this show as well. It is at VOA _ IE. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Autism spectrum disorder is seen across the globe. It's five times more common in boys, and the diagnosis is usually made at about age four. Genevieve Zappula realized there was something different about her son Henry early on.
He just didn't have that same level of interaction.
Researchers from Australia's La Trobe University in Melbourne have created an app to help parents who suspect their child may have autism.
We know that early intervention can actually improve children's developmental outcomes.
Dr. Josephine Barbaro says that the autism app called AS Detect takes parents through a series of steps to help identify whether their child as young as 12 months may have autism. Genevieve Sapula's son Henry was diagnosed with autism at age two.
By the time he goes to school, that he will be at that stage where he won't be having those issues with settling and social interaction.
I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
I'm Michael Lippin with VOA's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said Tuesday he will head to Moscow next week to talk with Russian President Vladimir Putin about his newly announced troop withdrawal from Syria. But the top U.S. diplomat also warned Russia that lasting peace will be impossible without a genuine political transition away from the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who's a longtime Russian ally and refuses to step down. Christopher Hill is a senior U.S. diplomat who served as ambassador to Iraq and also a former assistant U.S. Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. In an interview Tuesday with VOA's DIWA service via Skype, Hill shared his perspective on Russia's troop withdrawal.
Well, I think it's obviously a very significant move. It probably reflects a couple of things. First of all, whenever one goes into one of these situations, you need an exit strategy. In the United States case, it's a very difficult process to exit a conflict. I think in Russia, bureaucratically, it's a little simpler. It's when Vladimir Putin decides it's time to pull out. But I think it may also reflect some concerns about the regime working with Assad and the prospects really for continued ground air and even ground operations. So I think the Russians may have decided to get out while the getting was good.
Well, Ambassador Hill also spoke to VOA DIWA about what needs to happen in Syria to bring an end to its civil war.
Well, it's very clear there needs to be a political solution to the various Sunni insurgency groups are not going to be able to press their will. It's clear that Assad, for all his faults, for all his evils, has been able to assemble a fairly powerful coalition of partners and allies. So, you know, one hopes there'll be some effort at some constitutional arrangements, which will get to the issue of power sharing. I think the Russians will continue to play a role in the peace process. And by the way, it's not even clear that all their air operations will have ceased. So I think we're kind of into the negotiating game. I think for many people, the holding of the ceasefire, the fact that it's more or less held, is quite a surprise. So I think we're now into perhaps into the main course here, and we'll see whether the UN, together with other interested parties, are going to be able to come up with some political arrangements that will satisfy the parties. I want to hasten to add that I don't think this is a matter of elections, and I don't think this is a matter of equipping or training or arming more insurgents on the ground. I think it's a matter of coming up with the political arrangements that will make this very complex country that has been complex for many, many, many decades to make this country somehow function again.
And that was U.S. Ambassador Christopher Hill. Myanmar's parliament has elected the country's first civilian president in 5 decades. U Thin Jaw was voted as the Southeast Asian nation's new leader on Tuesday, gaining 360 of 652 points in both chambers. Trevor Wilson is a visiting fellow at the Australian National University and a former Australian diplomat posted to Myanmar. He told VOA's Victor Beattie that Thin Jaw is a person of utmost integrity and a close confidant of Aung San Suu Kyi. Wilson says Thin Jaw will likely be more of a ceremonial figure than his outgoing predecessor, Thein Sein.
That's not to understate what the role is. It's still very significant, very important, and often the president is the legal authority for everything. He authorizes appointments, he authorizes many things, and U Thin Jaw will do that, but he'll be doing that on getting advice from the leader of his party, and that's Aung San Suu Kyi.
And what direction do you anticipate the country will now take?
It's going to be a little bit different, but not as different as some people seem to expect. It's not going to change directions, and a lot of things are not going to change overnight. So I think we have to all realize that there's going to be a lot of things that are just continued from the past, that a lot of things that the NLD government wants to fix up are actually going to take a little bit of time to fix up because they're bigger issues, they're strategic, they're institutional, they take time for a new way of thinking, a new culture to develop. So I don't think it's realistic to expect that there's going to be a massive change overnight. I think we'll see a gradual transition to a more democratic government, and a government that is more interested in the welfare of the people than previous governments in Myanmar.
Well, as you know from your own experience, the country is emerging from decades of isolation and military rule. It has some massive economic problems, also ethnic and sectarian tensions. What might be the new government's priority?
I think the new government's priorities will be on resolving some of these divisions between the people, and try to overcome some of the gaps that the people have in terms of health and education and welfare, I guess, generally. Economic opportunity also needs to be improved, but Myanmar actually has quite a lot of assets. They've got a lot of resources. Their people are generally not uneducated. They're not as well educated as they could be. They're generally very hardworking. I think we'll find the country does reasonably well. Foreign investors are going to be quite important because the country won't have enough capital on its own, so it'll need to have assistance and collaboration with foreign investors, including in providing technology, I might add.
And that was Trevor Wilson, a former Australian diplomat posted to Myanmar, speaking with International Edition's Victor Beattie. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. If you've ever wanted to see what life was like in another time, a new virtual reality app lets you do just that. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, the Time Looper app is taking people back in time at several historic sites.
If you visit the Tower of London, you will see the building with the moat drained. But if you use a new Time Looper app, the modern city melts away and you're in 1255 London. What are now city streets are fields, and the tower is surrounded by water, all by using your smartphone and a simple cardboard viewer. Andrew Feinberg is the co-founder of Time Looper, which uses virtual reality technology on your smartphone to transport you to another time.
We actually overlay the current infrastructure with what the infrastructure of the tower and the surrounding environment was like in 13th century London. So, for example, now you see a Starbucks, and now you see the tower as it looks today with the moat drain. When we take you back in time, you actually see the historically accurate representation of the tower in its heyday.
Feinberg and his co-founder, Yit Yitter, first do historical research on the sites. Then they record the modern site in 360-degree virtual reality video. Then, using a green screen and costumed actors, they recreate the site as it was in an earlier time. After some 3D modeling and some visual effects, suddenly Trafalgar Square in London is not in 2016, but in 1940 during the Nazi Blitzkrieg. Swarms of German bombers appear in the sky, and one actually drops a bomb near Nelson's Column, an iconic landmark in London. Yit Yitter says the technology enhances the experience for people who might see the modern view but have no idea what happened there.
Nothing replaces the experience of being on site, but you don't always know what the stories are about those sites. So the first thing is, experience those destinations, Colosseum, even without going there and getting more excited about that destination. And then the second thing is, when you arrive, learning more about those stories.
Time Looper is a boon for the tourist industry, allowing visitors to see the Great Fire of London or the Thames River's Tower Bridge before it was a bridge. Ruth Poling is a Blue Badge tourist guide in London.
I think it's just really, really immersive. I mean, my job is a storyteller. I'm here to conjure up what things are like. And this just gives me something else I can use, particularly with small children, getting them really engaged in the story that I'm telling.
Chris Early, the head of Tower Bridge, says Time Looper helps people understand the impact of historical events.
You might be able to experience the looking at the Great Fire from stood at home, but when you're actually up here in the walkways, you get a sense of where it all happened. And of course, the second that the experience finished, you're looking at exactly the same view, but in the modern day. So it gives it a lot more context.
Time Looper plans to launch in New York City in April. There, visitors will be able to see Times Square on VJ Day in August of 1945. They'll also get to see workers eating lunch atop a skyscraper during construction of Rockefeller Center in 1932. Following their launch last year, Feinberg and Yitter have been busy doing deals with other locations, from China to Spain. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And that's it for International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
28 years ago, on March 16, 1988, the regime of then-president of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, committed one of the worst atrocities of the modern era. The murder by poison gas of thousands of civilians in the Kurdish-Iraqi town of Halabja. As part of the Al-Anfal operation, a genocidal campaign against the Kurds and other ethnic groups in northern Iraq, government forces spent 2 days shelling the city of Halabja with rockets and napalm, an incendiary gel that sticks to skin and causes terrible burns. But come early evening of the second day, March 16th, they suddenly changed tactics. Attacking aircraft began to pepper the civilian parts of the city with canisters of chemical weapons, including mustard gas and the nerve agents sarin, tabun, and VX. That day, some 3,500 to 5,000 people died within minutes. Another 7,000 to 10,000 were injured, crippled, or suffered long-term health problems. Although there is some evidence that Saddam Hussein's forces had used chemical agents before March 16, 1988, the attack on Halabja is thought to be the Al-Anfal campaign's first documented assault using chemicals, but it would not be the last. Early in 1987, Saddam Hussein authorized the use of chemical weapons in attacks on as many as 24 Kurdish villages. For his role in these heinous attacks, the dictator's cousin and the campaign's commander, Ali Hassan al-Majid, earned the nickname Chemical Ali. Al-Anfal was a series of horrific crimes perpetrated by Iraqi leaders against their own civilian population. and the gassing of the citizens of Halabja was that campaign's worst atrocity. For his part in it and for other crimes, Chemical Ali was executed by hanging. The Iraqi Special Tribunal dropped charges against Saddam Hussein himself only because he was executed after being convicted in a separate case. The head of government has a responsibility to the country and to its people to act in their best interest. Ultimately, few dictators die in bed or exit the scene of their crimes gracefully. The fate of those who instigated the Al-Anfal and killed thousands of innocents in Halabja should serve as a warning to others who follow in their murderous footsteps.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.